Like Call It What You Want, which we know is your favorite podcast about the beautiful game, Vuori is committed to delivering a great experience for everyone, which is highlighted by their new perspective on performance apparel. Everything is designed to work out in, but doesn't look or feel like it. In fact, I'm rocking their Stratotech polo right now, along with their Sunday performance jogger pants, so I can be business on top when I'm on camera, but super comfortable on the bottom. And it's just the best. Vuori gear is incredibly versatile, and it can be used for just about any activity. Running, training, swimming, lounging around, hosting podcasts, doing errands, whatever your heart desires, because Vuori is an investment in your happiness. And for our listeners, they are offering 20% off your first purchase. So go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at Vuori.com/call it. That's Vuori.com/call it. Not only will you receive 20% off your first purchase, but enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Go to Vuori.com/call it and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Hello and welcome to your favorite average to good podcast. Call it what you want. Happy Earth Day as well. We got a great show for you today as me, Jimmy Conrad, Jesse Marsh, and Charlie Davies dig into some fun subjects. One not so fun, that's Sergiño Dest getting hurt. We're going to talk about the impact of what that looks like for the U.S. men's national team this summer. We got two fantastic guests joining the show. We'll do Americans Abroad from the best performances, or maybe not so great performances from this past weekend. And of course, we'll just get into it and we'll go off on tangents because that's what we do. But first, we got the word of the day. Are you ready?
On the back of our first draw, Jimmy, we're calling it a draw last week. Yep.
Calling it a draw. It was close.
Yeah, it was.
It was.
I mean, I don't want to get into the logistics of like who actually said what first or second. There's no need. We're calling it a draw.
We're calling it a draw. Okay. All right, you guys ready? Here's the word today. Today we're focusing. We should have a crossbar challenge. I don't know how we do that. We have to be in the same spot to make that happen next time. Yep. But today we're focusing on the word for the person in charge of keeping both teams in check, the referee. In one corner of the world, the ref is better known as Simpan.
Thailand.
What language is this? Where is this word
spoken? Sounds like
spoken?
Thailand for me.
Okay, Thailand right off the top. Jesse, you want with an early one before I get to the clues?
I will go. He's a Simpan.
Simpan.
Clearly,
yeah.
Clearly, a Simpan is Botswana. We haven't guessed Botswana in a while.
We haven't. Nope. You are both incorrect. Okay, clue number one. A national team that speaks this language caused one of the greatest upsets in World Cup history when it defeated Italy to advance out of the group stage in the 1966 edition. Okay. I don't know if that helps you at all. National team. I'll give you one more. Another national team that speaks this language has competed in each of the last 10 men's World Cups.
Another team that speaks this language has competed in each of the last 10 men's World Cups.
Serbia.
Jesse.
Croatia. I'm going to say Croatia, actually. I'm going to go with Croatia.
You're both wrong. The best result for this country came in 2002.
Okay.
When they finished in
Turkey.
Fourth.
South Korea.
Wow. It's Chuck. Yeah. Chuck got it. Yeah. Chuck, that's a Simpan.
All right. Simpan.
Jesse.
Chugu.
Simpan.
Chugu. What do you mean? I know it as Chugu, not Simpan.
No, Chugu is soccer.
Oh, he sorry.
Chuku. Okay. Chuku is soccer, but Simpan is referee. Okay, so let's Chuku and Simpan our way into the next topic, which is some bad news. Word is coming out of PSV that Sergiño Dest significantly hurt his knee, and he's going to be out for a significant amount of time. This is their statement. Serginho Dest suffered what appears to be a serious knee injury during Saturday's training session. How long the winger will be sidelined? I think it's interesting they call him a winger. How long the winger will be sidelined is still being investigated. That will be an extended period of time is almost certain. So now it's looking like Dest could miss the Copa America. And right.
I got a big question with this.
Go for it.
Because typically when we see something like this, you know right away if it's an ACL, right? ACL, 6 months at the very minimum. They did not say that. So does that mean that this is a significant knee injury that isn't ACL related? Or is this ACL plus others and we can't confirm?
I would guess that it's like meniscus related or something more similar to that. But, you know, you're right. Because usually if it's ACL, there like that's usually comes out because there's not much to hide if it's a 6 to 8 month injury.
Right.
So I would, based on the wording there, but again, you never know. It could be, it's obviously vague. But I would guess that it's not ACL. That would be my
right.
guess.
All right,
which means there's hope. There's hope that he could still be in Copa America.
Maybe because he's on loan, Barcelona needs to give him a scan first before there's anything that's announced. Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
And you know what else is? I mean, with you know, as much as ACLs take a long time in today's day and age, players come back from those all the time and have almost no issues. But if it's meniscus, right, or cartilage related, then you can have more long-term factors at play there.
Well, obviously, we're hoping for the very best for Serginho, a key player for the U.S. men's national team. And now, Greg Berhalter and his coaching staff are going to have to adjust to this news. Even if it's a meniscus or if it's something that's minor, that at times is usually 4 to 6 weeks, which could still rule him out of the Copa America as well. So now I wonder, how do we adjust? And Chuck, I know that you were on Morning Footy, and you had mentioned that Timo Weah could be the guy that steps into the right back. And I'm a fan of that, but can you please extrapolate your thought process on Timo Weah?
Yes. I mean, we can go back to two seasons ago. Timothy Weah was playing right back and left back for an entire season with Lille and a competitive Lille in Liga. And so goes to Juve, signed as a right wing back to replace Cuadrado, who went to Inter Milan. So we know long-term, he told me, I see myself as an outside winger, outside wing back for my career. I think I'll play the longest there. I'll be the most consistent there. And I think long-term, that's the best position for me to move forward. But obviously, I like playing in the attacking right wing role for Greg Berhalter and the U.S. men's national team. So you're going to have a player who's committed to playing that position, a player who's already played it in Europe for a full season. And I think he has a lot to offer, given what Serginho Dest does for the team, right? Getting into the attack. I think he's really developed well with his timing of his runs, his overlaps, Timothy Weah. So I will feel very confident in Timothy Weah playing that position and still contributing a lot in the attacking half than I will with any other player.
Okay, so Jesse, Timo Weah played this past weekend for Juve. They were down 2-0, come back and make it 2-2 versus Cagliari. And
that's my American abroad pick, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You had Weston McKennie, who actually came in for Timo around the 68th minute. But they were playing in a back three. Maxi Allegri had them in a back three, and Timo Weah playing that wing back position. Is that something that? Because that's something I want to get into with you guys is the possibility of us playing in the back three. But talk to me about Timo Weah in that Serginho Dest spot first.
My feeling from this game was that he didn't have a bad performance, but he doesn't, for me, look comfortable there. He looks more comfortable in the attacking part of the field. He'll do the work to come back and help defend for his team. There's no doubt that he has that built into him. But he seems too often like he's stuck on the touchline, like he's not involved in the match, like he doesn't know when he wants to come inside or come back or make runs in the deep. So in general, he wasn't the problem why they went 2-0 down. It's been a kind of a weird season for me with Timo Weah, where he hasn't really established himself with Juventus. And it was one of these days we're playing at Cagliari and it's not an easy place to play. but he wasn't a big positive on the day. And actually then they subbed him out. They went to four in the back. They put Weston McKennie in, and Weston just with his energy changed the game, and they wound up coming back and drawing the game 2-2. So I'm not convinced that Team Awea would be an applicable sub for Dest at the right back position. But when you look at Scally's performance, when you look at the other options that you have there, it may be the best scenario that the U.S. has right now. So I'm not sure. I mean, it's interesting that you said that he feels like his best long-term position is the wingback. Because for me, he was great as a striker earlier in his career, whether it was Lille or different places he's been. I like him as an attacking player. I like him as somebody who tests the back line, who's dynamic in the attacking third, who can go 1v1. And obviously, you can apply some of those things when you play wingback or fullback. But in general, his instincts to me are much more of an attacking player than they are a defending player.
I just want to attribute probably... if I'm thinking about Tim Weah in this way, that Allegri's not an easy manager to play for, especially in your first season. And it's so easy to get caught in your own head thinking about where do I have to be and when do I have to be, because he's particular. Wait.
Chuck, don't they say the same thing about Greg Berhalter?
And look at Weston.
I just tried to poke the bear.
Look at Weston. Same thing. It took him a while to adjust to Allegri's tactics and demands. You would have probably said the same thing early on in Weston's career with Juve, because you're trying to impact the game, but at the same time, you're trying to stay in the team. And so ultimately, whatever the manager says or his instructions, you're trying to just play his way like a robot and not let it just come natural. And I think that happens for a lot of players.
In the end, Jimmy, I think regardless, what we saw from the Jamaica game is... and I've been saying this, I think, even when we've talked about different players that we're watching with Americans abroad, is the fullback position is when we have Dest and Robinson available, it's not a weakness. It's a strength of our team. But if one of those two goes down, we don't have a lot of answers. Where do we go from here? That's a good question.
Well, I want to provide that. I think I have a solution.
Okay, let's hear it.
I'm interested in a back three, and hear me out, where because you can have Anthony Robinson really owning that left channel and really getting up and down. At times, I feel like when he has the ball, Christian is in front of him demanding the ball or wanting the ball, which is fine. And when we can isolate Christian to be in 1v1 situations, that's great. But if we could get Jedi a little bit more up and down and free and not being cluttered at times, and this allows... I guess I'm going to...
So what does that midfield look like?
Okay, good question. So let's say this. We have back three of Tim Ream in the middle, right? So you have someone that can control the rhythm. He's obviously a great passer. You could put Cameron Carter-Vickers, who played 90 minutes this past weekend, on the right side, or Miles Robinson. Chris Richards on the other side. He did that at Hoffenheim, I believe, Chris Richards. So he's comfortable in a three. And then you have Timo Weah playing that right wing back spot where he can get up and down a little bit more. But it's almost like a fluid back four. If Weah goes bombing forward... then Jedi can just tuck in. And then
Would you play this regardless if Dest is healthy or not?
I wanted to. We've had this conversation before. I would consider it. But now it's like, well, who do you sacrifice somewhere else to make that happen?
Listen, now, for sure, Chris Richards could. I mean, Chris Richards played against us in Champions League when I was at Salzburg as a left fullback. He can play specifically defensively the right fullback position. Right. And then if they rotate into a three buildup and slide Timo Weah out wide, that is a possible solution, no doubt. But still, then you need to get the right kind of center back solutions as well, because I think that Tim Ream is clearly and by the way, I think Tim more in the left channel and building with his left foot is a big advantage. But I understand why you say you'd put him in the middle, because he is sort of the leader of that back line. But they've got to figure out how to get that balance right. But that's a potential solution, no doubt.
OK, so one of the things, too, I want to shout out the Fulham manager, Marco Silva, for resting Tim Ream right now. Tim's not playing a lot. He's going to be fresh and ready to go for Copa America. Tyler Adams, we'll get into him. He's got a bit of an injury issue, but he'd be starting there. And then this is where I want to get with the conversation. But with Gio Reyna coming inside would be your other midfielder.
So right.
So you'd have
Tyler
Weston
and Weston. OK,
Yes. And then, yeah, and then
top.
You'd have and your then, inverted. No, you'd have, sorry, let me do it like this. Let me paint.
Yeah, you'd have, so Christian, you'd have Christian in a striker, then whether it's Balogun or
exactly right,
whatever.
Exactly right.
And you'd give but Christian a little bit of freedom to roam around. He could go out wide at times. He could, yeah, no, for sure. For
cool.
Sure.
Yeah, bad. So you could almost have inverted tens. You could have a square in midfield if you wanted and have Weston
or a diamond
at the bottom
or
of the
a
square.
Diamond.
Yeah. Or diamonds, right? Exactly right. And then you have Balogun up high. I just think that gives us a little bit of flexibility. You could have that fluid back four, and now you're not, I don't know, you give a little bit more freedom to the outside. What I think is interesting is you could have, given that we saw Weston McKennie play a little bit on the right side, and because there's now this, I don't know, maybe it's the flavor of the month, but where you have your outside right back in a four, like a Trent Alexander-Arnold or a John Stones that now slides into midfield and can kind of build for build-up play, but then also when you're trying to hold another team in, if you're trying to do high press, there's something you could do there with Weston as well if you wanted and not have team away in that spot. But you, what I'm saying is I think we have the opportunity and the players to try this, and I hope that we see us try to do it in one of these two friendlies before the Copa America starts, because it could unlock our potential a little bit more. But go ahead.
So try a new system against Brazil or Colombia.
Well, it is a new system and it isn't. It is a new system and isn't.
Exactly.
Like I would rather have, like, let's just say Richards, Robinson, and Ream in the back three buildup than when they had Richards, Ream, and Gio Reyna, right? That makes more sense. And put Gio Reyna further up the field, slide Tim Awea out wide. Like, you can create other rotations with Tyler and Gio and Weston in the midfield, and you can give Christian the freedom to roam around, go wide sometimes, come underneath, like be on the back line. Like I think that could work for sure. And it doesn't really change the overall system of what Berhalter likes to do. So yeah, I mean,
I just got the stamp of approval. I'll take
the only thing
that
I would change if Timothy Weah does come back to play right back, is then you can move Christian to the right and Haji Wright as the left winger.
That's true.
And Gio Reyna as the build-up player in the back line.
And Gio, still stay high. Don't you come back. Don't you dare.
All right. Lots to get into there. I will say, though, Chuck, to your point about one of the friendlies versus Colombia and Brazil, if it works against that quality, if we did it against a smaller team or a team we know that we're going to dominate anyway, right, you don't really know.
It's not a good sample size.
Have to answer certain questions, but if you play against one of those two teams and it does work, then you're like, okay. Or
listen,
even if
you
in a little bit,
what you get, listen, Dest is good at breaking a team down, right? He's really creative on the ball and he's good 1v1 and he's good at joining in the attack late. What you get for sure is a better team on set pieces. You get a better defensively team. The structure now, just like of how you're going to defend, is better. Right. And maybe against some of the better opponents, that's a better recipe for success.
Obviously, the formation is going to be a big conversation piece for us as we get closer to the friendlies in Copa America itself. But we're going to take our first break of Call It What You Want. When we come back, we're going to be talking to a very special guest, the goalkeeper for the Columbus Crew, Patrick Schulte. And we're going to be wearing different clothes because we cut this interview last week. You're going to enjoy this. Don't go anywhere.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome back to Call It What You Want. I'm Jimmy Conrad alongside Jesse Marsh, and thankfully not Charlie Davies, because we have a very special guest joining us. 23-year-old goalkeeper from the Columbus Crew, Patrick Schulte. Patrick, thank you so much for your time. It's great to see you.
Yes, Patrick.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Okay, so Patrick, confirm or deny whether this is true for me. You got drafted in the first round of the MLS Super Draft by the Columbus Crew. This is in 2022. You elected to, or maybe somebody else made the decision, you went and played with the MLS Next Pro team, Columbus Crew 2. in that time, that season, you went on to win the first ever MLS Next Pro Cup trophy, and you were the Next Pro Goalkeeper of the Year. Correct? True?
True.
Okay, true. Then you get your first season with the first team, Columbus Crew, and you win MLS Cup in your first season. True?
True.
Okay, so every time you go somewhere and play, you're winning trophies. So this is me saying, you better be on the Olympic team so we can win gold. And then I just think we should put you on the 2026 World Cup roster. What do you say to those two things?
I'm all for them, honestly. I'd love to.
All right, so talk to us a little bit about your performance, starting with, let's go to the CONCACAF Champions Cup, because you're clearly on your way to winning that trophy as well. Tremendous second leg against Tigres in Monterrey. You made a mistake, but what I really loved about that is that you came back and totally redeemed yourself, to borrow a quote from my favorite movie, Dumb and Dumber, and you made some hell of a saves along the way to get to penalties, and now you're here in the next round. Talk to us through that experience.
Yeah, it was a crazy one. Definitely thankful that, you know, the guys were able to get to penalties and, you know, allow me to, you know, kind of leave my impact on the game. But, yeah, just kind of, you know, the emotions of, you know, letting in that goal three minutes into the game and, you know, just kind of staying focused and staying at the task at hand. I knew we had to score an away goal, so I just knew I needed to keep a clean sheet for the rest of the game and just allow our attackers and allow the team to kind of create the magic that they always seem to be able to do. And yeah, I was obviously fortunate enough to, you know, keep that clean sheet for the rest of the game and save a couple penalties along the way.
And the environment down there in Monterrey, I mean, it's an amazing place to play. The two teams in Monterrey right now are so good. And obviously you play now Monterrey in the second or in the semifinal. Yeah, talk to us about that environment, playing away in Mexico, how you felt, the excitement, responding the way Jimmy said. Take us through all that.
Yeah, it's obviously a super cool place to play. I think that was, you know, that was my first time playing in front of 40,000, which is obviously, you know, something super special. But yeah, I think just, you know, just the crowd, how they rally around their teams is crazy. And, you know, it's something that you don't see a whole lot here in America, just, you know, 40,000 screaming the whole game. So, you know, obviously just trying to stay calm as much as possible. And, you know, at the end of the day, you want to disappoint all those fans. So that was kind of my goal. After the, you know, first 5 minutes of the game was, all right, like, let's just settle in, you know, these fans are here to watch you play and, let's make sure we disappoint them. And yeah, it was, you know, I'm excited to kind of go back down there. I know Monterrey's stadium's 53,000, so, you know, a little bit bigger crowd, and, you know, hopefully we can disappoint some more fans.
Yeah, I love that, and I love that mentality and attitude. So talk to me a little bit, because not only was it your first year with the Columbus Crew or the first team with the Columbus Crew last season, it was also your coach, Wilfred Nancy. Talk to us about what's made him so special and why he's pushing all the right buttons to get you guys playing as well as you are.
I think it's just his mindset. Obviously, you know, his approach to the games and his tactics are you know, next level, but I think just his collectiveness and, you know, his desire to, you know, want to win, but also win the right way and keep the locker room together as one and kind of have everyone bought into the same identity. You know, he's always pushing the right buttons within the team, saying the right things as well. I think, you know, going into this last leg against Tigres, you know, everyone kind of had us as the underdog, but for him, it was, you know, they should respect us and we shouldn't fear anybody. You know, we obviously respect everyone, but don't fear anyone. And, you know, I think that was kind of his mindset of, you know, we're going to come out here, we're going to do it. And he just instilled that in us from day one. And I think that's just what makes him so special, is what he believes is what he wants from each and every guy. And so he's going to do whatever it takes to, you know, show that to the team, and, you know, he gets all the guys to buy in.
We had Tanner Tessman on last week, and we talked to him about the Olympic team. He was great. You can see he's a really composed guy, and he had a lot of positive things to say about the experience overall. Obviously, that France game is a great result, and it sounded like the whole camp was a good experience for you guys and a chance for you to come together before the actual Olympics. now knowing you play France again, you know, hoping that you'll make the Olympic team, obviously, thinking about overage players, we've even spoken about, you know, typically there's a goalkeeper that goes, but we think that there's good goalkeepers in your age group right now. So, you know, what are you thinking about the experience with the team, what that camp was like, looking forward to the Olympics, what you're hopeful for? Kind of give us an outlook on the whole experience and looking forward to the summer.
Yeah, I hope to be on that team. And, you know, I'd love to be on that team just to be able to represent the United States at the Olympics. But, you know, most importantly, you know, the group of guys is amazing. You know, we all kind of click really well just for having like three camps now. So just I think, you know, how well we are off the field together and how close we've kind of gotten throughout the three camps. But as well as on the field, you know, we're all kind of starting to understand, you know, how everyone plays and how to play together. I think that was one of the biggest things, you know, biggest takeaways from this last camp was, you know, really understanding, you know, just how everyone plays and how, you know, Marco wants the team to play. And then obviously the France game, you know, showing that, you know, there's no quit from any of the guys and that we all, you know, we're going to compete for 90 minutes. And no matter, you know, what the scoreline is, we're going to go to the end. And we have talent from, you know, all the starters to the depth of the bench. Anyone can play at any given moment. And yeah, I think that was one of the biggest takeaways that I learned is, you know, how you know, close we're coming, but you know, the fight that is within the group.
Now, Patrick, before we ask you the next question, I guess we're going to add Charlie Davies into this interview as well. Chuck, great to see you, my friend.
Yes,
how are you doing?
I made it. Yeah. You made it.
This is such a bad impression. I mean, Patrick's just starting on his career. He's learning discipline and punctuality and that performance. Well, and then Patrick, this is what you bring. This is what you bring.
Patrick, because I've been up since 2:30 a.m. and I've worked all the way until now to make sure that I was here for your interview. And I had to ask you this question. So, you know, it's almost very, very difficult to get a high rating in L'Équipe, right? And the major French newspaper. You play in that U23 match in Sochaux, my old club, a beautiful stadium, which I'm sure you agree with. But you had an incredible performance. That's one of the favorites in the Olympics. Thierry Henry's French side, obviously, they're going to add three overage players that could range from Mbappe to Griezmann to Dembele, who knows, right? But what did you learn the most about France in that match? And what did it do for your squad heading into the Olympic Games?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing obviously that you learned is, you know, they got a lot of talent all over the field, but at the same time, you know, we were able to sustain possession a decent amount, and especially in the second half, and you know, we were able to create chances. We didn't put our chances away early enough, I feel like. Especially, you know, looking back on the game, we had some chances that we could have, you know, made it 1-0, 2-0 early in the game. But we also were able to defend them really well. And yeah, I think, you know, the team learned a lot about, you know, just being able to come back as well. And that, you know, we're able to, you know, play for all 90 minutes. So yeah, you know, they're favorites, but at the same time, just like Wilfred says, you know, don't take the underdog mentality and, you know, respect them, but don't fear them. And just let's go out there and play our game.
Who's he rooting for when you play France? Wilfred.
There's room for us to do well. I know that. He's told me that before.
All right, you'll take that. All right, Patrick, let's look ahead to your big game against Monterrey in the first leg of the CONCACAF Champions Cup. You're facing a familiar foe in Brandon Vasquez. Used to play for Columbus's hated rivals, FC Cincinnati. He scored against you guys in the playoffs last season. How do you slow him down? Because he's had a very good start with Monterrey since he's made the move.
Yeah, obviously, you know, he's a fantastic player, and you know, he's a really good box finisher, really good hold up play, and can run in behind. So honestly, just knowing where he's at all times, and just knowing, you know, that he's going to try and, you know, either make a layoff and then run in behind, or you know, he's going to try and lose a man and get free in the box. So just kind of knowing where he's at, as well as, you know, understanding the talent that they have around him that can make a play. So yeah, it's gonna be fun. You know, I'm excited to play him again because he got the best of me last time. But hopefully I can get my revenge.
You just played against Jignac. Of course, you're ready for anything. Come on now, jeez. Come on, Jimmy.
What?
He's played against Tigres.
I was getting specific. He scored against him last time, Chuck. I just thought he's going to get his la revancha now. He can get the revenge. It's fine. It's no big deal.
True.
I mean, this is Monterrey is a good team, right? I think right now they're the way they're playing, they're the favorites. And although Club America is also very good, do you know, there's so much talk around MLS and about the Mexican teams versus the MLS teams and trying to elevate so that we can win this tournament more often. Now you guys are the last team standing. I mean, when you're out on the pitch and you see the level of the opponent and the football, what I always like about playing the Mexican teams is the football is also a little different, right? You almost have to adjust your game and know what they're good at and still try to play to your strengths. I mean, what do you think about the MLS versus Liga MX rivalry matchups, and what do you think about your matchup with Monterrey?
Yeah, I love it. You know, it's like you said, it's different. You know, the way that they play is different than a lot of teams in MLS. But at the same time, I think, especially in the Tigres matchup, you know, I think we caused them problems. And the way we play, it's, you know, we want to control the ball, we want to control the game, but they also have, you know, really talented players from, you know, their striker to their right back to their left back to the goalkeeper, and they want to hit you in transition, and they're really good individually. So, you know, understanding that, you know, while we're trying to control them and break them down, they're good, they can spring out and hit you in transition in 10 seconds, and they can make something out of nothing. So it's, you know, going into the game, yeah, we might not be favorites, but, you know, I still like our chances. You know, we're gonna play our style, and we'll see how that goes.
I have to agree with you, Patrick. I like your chances as well, because you guys just have a quality team. You play a great brand, and I think you guys are adaptable. You know how to press, you know how to keep possession, and you've proven it with beating Tigres. So, what's another giant to slay with Monterrey? My final question with you is, here towards the Olympics, you know, I look back at the 2008 Olympic team that we had, and man, we had a great opportunity to medal, and we let it slip out of our hands, especially starting the group off with a big win against Japan and the 90th minute equalizer that Netherlands had against us. I think that really threw a wrench into our plans. And then we lost on a red card in the final match to Nigeria, who ended up getting the silver medal. We lost 2-1. But I look at your group and I say, man, you have a lot of talent, especially the players who are playing with the first team. If you could include them, you know, the likes of Balogun, Pepe, Reyna, right? But what makes your group different? What are the strengths of your group? What do you think will end up helping you get a medal in this Olympics?
I think we have different players all over the field. I think you look at like our wing position with Griffin Yao in this last camp. You know, he was a really good player running that guy's one on one, and then you sub Cade Cowell on who can stretch a game. You know, especially, you know, late in that France game where it's, you know, the guy, the back line's tired. They've been, you know, playing for 80 minutes. He comes on just as making, you know, run after run in behind, as well as, you know, the midfield with Tanner, who's, you know, a very good distributor of the ball, but also, you know, was going to track back and make a 70-yard run to win a tackle. So I think we got guys all over the field that are just different, but we're all there for, you know, obviously the same collective objective. And, you know, like I said earlier, we're all very close, and we all want, you know, what's best for the team, and we're going to give that, you know, game in and game out. And so I think that's what kind of makes us different is, you know, we have different guys and different play styles, but at the same time, we all can play and understand the way that each player wants to play.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for your time. Good luck against Monterrey this upcoming season.
All the best,
and of course,
buddy.
In the Olympics and for your future. Patrick Schulte, everybody.
CBS Sunday after the equalizer.
You collect rewards, right?
This is how I make my living.
It's the season finale.
Everyone's looking for something.
Of Tracker.
You strong swimmer?
So-so.
So-so. So-so's okay. Justin Hartley stars.
How you survive, you make quick, smart decisions, and you never let panic take the wheel.
Sounds cool.
It is cool, actually. Very cool.
Tracker, CBS season finale Sunday after The Equalizer on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
Welcome back to Call It What You Want. It's your favorite segment, Americans Abroad, and we're going to talk about some notable performances from our player pool. We're going to start with Haji Wright. Scored the equalizer against Manchester United to take the FA Cup semifinal to extra time. He had an assist in extra time, but he got slightly offside. That would have been next level. Unfortunately, Coventry loses in penalties to a Man United team that's not very good. Then Gianluca Busio, he scored the winning goal versus Lecco for Venezia. That is a big deal. Cameron Carter-Vickers played a full 120 minutes. As Celtic reached the Scottish FA Cup final after winning in penalties in the semis, Luca De La Torre returned from injury in a 4-1 win, a big 4-1 win for Celta Vigo over Las Palmas. And then Gio Reyna makes his second straight start in a 2-0 defeat for Forest against Everton. That one's going to hurt Forest a little bit as they try to stay out of the relegation zone. But we had some other notable performances. Johnny Cardoso had a very good performance for Real Betis. Big win for them over Valencia. Keeps them in the conversation to finish in sixth in La Liga. Tanner Tessman actually had the assist to Busio in that game for Venezia. Charlie, I'm coming to you first. Who really stood out for you? Who do you want to highlight?
I want to highlight Chris Richards, just getting back in the team. It's been, what, four matches before since we've seen him play? So to see him in the team against a strong West Ham side who's been up and down this year, but relatively they have some good players, especially if you're talking about Mikel Antonio Kudus, Lucas Paqueta, and Ward-Prowse, right? Those are players who can hurt you on their day. And I mean, they absolutely blew out West Ham. It wasn't even a contest. And I thought he was really good on the day, just his positioning, completed 96% of his passes, only two he didn't connect. So I think from that standpoint, he is exceptional when you're not asking him to make the game for you. You want Chris Richards to be a center back and defend first and foremost. The other two players, Anderson and who do you play alongside? Anderson, they played in a back three, Anderson and Klein. They took most of the touches building out of the back. And so I really like what I saw from Chris Richards. I think this season has been awesome for him, for his growth and development, playing consistently in the English Premier League. And it took him a while to get in, but kudos to Chris Richards. We all know what a good person he is. So it's good to see that.
Yeah, it's exciting. Now even more relevant since we've lost Serginho Dest for the Copa America as well. If we want to slot into that back three, we know that Greg listens to the show from time to time. Make sure you hit like and subscribe, Greg. We appreciate that. Jesse, player to watch, Americans Abroad. Who are you going with?
Why are you stirring the pot, Jimmy? Why are you stirring the
pot?
It's part
of my charm, Jesse.
He can't help it. He can't help it. Text also, coming through. Cameraman,
we potentially lost Serginho Dest. We don't know for sure if we lost Serginho Dest, but I'm projecting my fear that we maybe lost Dest for the fun. Anyway,
I already talked about my Americans Abroad. I talked about Team Awea and Weston McKennie. So the only thing I'm going to touch on is that Tyler Adams, again, was not in the squad. So I think it's three or four matches in a row since he had the 90-minute performance. You know, this was a discussion point when he came in with the national team and then when he played 90 minutes, when he went back again,
but don't you think it would have been fine if he played 60, Jesse?
I think it would have been hard either way, Charlie, because when you travel across the continent, you haven't played football in a year. Really? He hadn't played. He played one match in the fall or like a 20 minute match and maybe he's hardly played. And you can only fail in these situations. And I've said it before, there's no like random occurrences, coincidences when it comes to handling players physically. Like injuries happen when you don't understand how you need to behave and how you need to train them. So again, it's a shame. And I think this will also be dangerous for him come the summer because we're not too far away. And I think he will need a really good buildup. He'll need a slow progressional buildup where he makes sure that he has zero setbacks. You cannot have another setback because if you get into this cycle of coming back and playing and then getting hurt again and coming back and playing and getting hurt again, it can be
tournament setting too.
Like, it can be months months before you're back to 100%. So I'm hopeful, Ty, that you're all right and that this isn't going to be too long, but obviously frustrated for him and frustrated that he's not at his top health and that he hasn't been for over a year.
Okay, so his head coach at Bournemouth, Andoni Iraola, said this: it's not a bad injury, and this is obviously regarding Tyler, and feeling pain in his muscle, but after so much time out, we have to be careful with these decisions. The medical department are dealing with it. I hope he will be back early.
Too late.
But definitely not for Villa. So Jesse goes, and Villa, they lost 3-1 to Villa this past weekend. So Jesse, do you think we shouldn't have called him in? I mean,
yes.
Even though he scored an absolute banger, probably the best goal ever scored in his career.
That was awesome, right? Good moment in his career, big for the national team. But no, leave him. They should have left him. Shouldn't have played 90 minutes when he went back. Like, give him time to progress, have a real slow progression where after weeks and months, he's back to 100%.
Do you think, though, listen, we've all been in this position. We all want to play every game 90 minutes. And I could see Tyler being very persuasive with the medical department, either for the national team or Bournemouth. I'm good. Just let me play. I just want to play. And do you think, and you've been around him in these situations, do you think that he maybe talked them into letting him play 90 minutes?
Maybe, but that's not. It's a mistake.
I get that.
Any way you look at it, it's a mistake.
Coaching staff, you still have to manage.
Everyone has to. And of course,
just think of concussion protocol. The guy's looking upside down. He's like, I'm good to play. Like, no matter what.
Yeah,
it's got to be on the medical staff to say, we have a plan for you. And I differ from you, Jesse, in saying, okay, I get the whole thing of we both agreed. I didn't think he should go, but once they said, hey, he's coming, Tyler wanted to go. Okay, what are the reasons for that? Let's assess him with the U.S. men's national team. Maybe he can play a little bit more. He can add value, which he certainly did, because let's be fair. The U.S., they're in the third, fourth place game in CONCACAF Nations League if Tyler Adams isn't there, right? So there's that part. But we're talking about a player's future and his health. I think after playing and going through what they agreed on in terms of minute restrictions, he goes back to Bournemouth. He's healthy. He got through them. It's on Bournemouth to say, you know what? We're going to take this slow, not throw him into a game and have him play 90 minutes. Everything had worked up until that point. So you clap your hands, you say, well, okay, Tyler's back. He's healthy. But we have to let his body adjust and give it time, because there are muscles that are compensating and working against you. So given his time out, we know we're very happy that he came out scot-free with no injury, but we can't throw him back into the lion's den. And especially to play him 90 minutes. I look at Bournemouth on this. This is on Bournemouth
for me. That's fair. That's fair.
It's on Tyler. It's the Bournemouth. It's the U.S. national team. It's everyone. I have experience with Tyler specifically and players that are injury prone, and you have to always be very, very cautious, very cautious. You have to go slower than you normally would with most return to play protocols, and you have to know exactly what their pitfalls are. And after a year out and not playing, don't discount that a year off from not playing is a long, long, long time.
Long ass time.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. All right. My player, we took a little sidebar there, and obviously hopefully Tyler's coming back sooner rather than later. But my player is Haji Wright. And Coventry, we're down 3-0 with 20 minutes left to go in the FA Cup semifinal at Wembley. And the capitulation for Manchester United started. And then there was a penalty. Aaron Wan-Bissaka got a handball called against him, 95th or 90 plus five extra minutes. And I thought, okay, who's going to step up for Coventry and take this penalty? And when I saw Haji Wright, guys, I was like, oh my God, Haji's going to step up. Please don't miss. Please don't miss. Please don't miss. And he couldn't have taken a more cool and calm and collected penalty than he did. And then he got, when they went into penalties, he took another one and buried that. I'm like, this guy. Ice in his veins. So very excited to see Haji Wright perform.
What about the offside?
The offside was so close. Listen, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, totally unaware of like everybody else holding the line. That guy is not a Manchester United player for me. That's a whole different conversation. I think he's a good player, but when I think about Man United and the types of players that they used to have, he doesn't fit that mold for. He's just not even paying attention. Anyway, we've seen it across the board, and that's me from the defensive side. That's me on the defensive side. I'm getting a little bit into my defensive instincts there, but Haji Wright, so close.
In general, isn't it so great to see? Again, I've referenced before on the show. I remember watching Haji Wright when he was 15, 16. Right. And always thinking he had such big potential. And now it just seems like it's maybe taken him a little bit more time, and maybe he hasn't always felt at home in the environments he's been in. But he really seems now like it's coming together, like he's gathering confidence, like the belief he has in himself. You mentioned the penalties, but I just think his performances in general this season have continued to elevate, and he's on a real upward trajectory. So amazing, and he still has so much potential for me to get even better physically. Like, he's technically gifted, he's good around the goal, he's got almost all the tools that you need, so he has potential to get better and better.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how he does and how he's utilized in our friendlies and then Copa America, of course, and obviously scored a couple goals in the Nations League. All right, some notable upcoming fixtures. By the time you hear this, the Milan Derby will have happened. Obviously, that has implications. If Inter win, they will win the Scudetto. We'll see if that actually happens or not. But there's some other ones. Tuesday, Lazio versus Juve. That's 3 p.m. Eastern. Coppa Italia semifinal. That's on the Golazo Network. Wednesday, Monaco versus Lille. That'll be 1 p.m. Eastern. Premier League time, Crystal Palace versus Newcastle. That'll be 3 p.m. Eastern. Also on Wednesday, a little nightcap for you. Columbus Crew taking on Monterrey, the first leg of the Champions Cup. That'll be 8:15 p.m. Eastern. And then Thursday, tie it up a little. Heerenveen versus PSV. So that's the schedule of the big games that are happening this week. But we have another guest joining us right after this break. And we're going to get into the growth of MLS and the marketing of the U.S. men's national team around the 2026 World Cup. And it should be a very good conversation. Looking forward to it. Don't go anywhere.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire, now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Welcome back to Call What You Want. I'm Jimmy Conrad alongside Jesse Marsh and Charlie Davies, and we have a very special guest joining us today, a distinguished author and professor of sports management at Syracuse University, Rick Burton. And one of the fun facts about Rick before we get to hear from him is that he's writing a book called The Rise of Major League Soccer, Building a Global Giant. It's with him and Norm O'Reilly. It's going to be dropping in early 2025. And honestly, Rick, I'm excited to have you on. The big question for me is, and this is me, I'm going to go first, is the impact of World Cups on this country. We had one in 94. We're having another one in 2026. Can the 2026 one be bigger than what we saw in 94?
Standards, it should be. And, you know, a big part of it is we've had 30 years of growth of football or soccer, depending on what word we want to use. Since 1994, I think the interesting piece is in 94, we were still figuring out that we wanted to be a part of the global game. And by 2002, we made quarters, right? And then all of a sudden we stopped making even the quarters. And then in 18, we don't even qualify. So it's been a crazy journey, but I think this FIFA World Cup in 26, you're going to see a lot of American appreciation for the game.
Rick, I'm curious, given what happened after 1994 with the World Cup on our home soil and the birth of Major League Soccer, if you're looking at marketing strategies for these big brands, how will they differ from 1994 to now in terms of the strategy, but also from Qatar 2022 to now? What are you expecting to see?
You know, Charlie, it's a great question. I think there's a number of factors you have to put in. In 1994, MLS didn't really exist. It was a dream. And so it certainly wouldn't have been considered kind of at the level of the NFL, you know, Major League Baseball, NBA, even the NHL. Now you skip forward 30 years and you got to put in the Messi factor, and you've got to put in that MLS has really joined what used to be a big four is now really a big five. And I think that the sponsors that are involved with sport are a lot more sophisticated than they were 30 years ago. The other wild card, I think, is Apple's deal with MLS and some of the Apple technology that's coming out. I think you got to factor in that technology is really changing sport at a rapid rate, you know, super rapid rate. And I think that MLS is well positioned to take advantage of it. And then you've got all these pieces that are going to fall into place. You're going to have Copa and later this year, Copa 24. And then I think you've got the FIFA Club Championship on in 25, mm-hmm. World Cup 26. And while the soccer in the Olympics in 28 doesn't really count in the FIFA world because it's largely under 23 teams, you've got an awful lot of excitement going to be built around soccer over the course of the next 4 years.
All right, Rick. First, thanks for coming on the show, because I feel like we're finally raising the level of intelligence of what we're doing on the show. So it's good to have you here.
That's true. That's true.
Now, I want to make this a multi kind of faceted question here. Let me ask you first, who's the most marketable player on this team?
I think part of the answer is that most mainstream Americans couldn't name one member of the U.S. men's national team. And so that's the start of the problem. I think, you know, if you want to drag a name out of me, we're going to have to arm wrestle later on.
So, you know, the reason I asked that question is because I have certain friends who claim that the women's athletes on the national team are actually more famous, like Megan Rapinoe, Alex Morgan. So I think that could be argued. I also have had a conversation with Tyler Adams at one point, and what he said to me is, you'd be surprised how famous Christian Pulisic is. And so I think that he's not always the most gregarious, extroverted personality. And I think that, you know, there are some good personalities in the team, and certainly Christian is a great player and a good person, but it will be, I think, interesting to see how the team gets marketed, how they maximize their potential, how individuals can maximize their potential. I mean, what kind of advice, what kind of things do you see coming out of that? What's the future look like in the next 2 years for the individuals on the U.S. national team?
Yeah, to paraphrase, or actually to rip off Al Davis, the old Oakland Raiders owner, you know, just win, baby. I mean, they need to perform, and they're going to have a couple of opportunities in the run up to 26. But essentially, you know, we're talking about the women, far greater, you know, recognition and awareness for, and even going back in time, I mean, we start talking about Mia Hamm or Julie Foudy or Carla Overbeck, Brandi Chastain, those women built a real platform so that Megan Rapinoe had something to step onto. The men don't have that benefit. So, and now you've got it, we're in a world of name, image, and likeness with college athletes. So between all the pro sports and Messi sucks in the best possible way. Messi sucks a lot of air out of the room when we talk about endorsements for soccer players. And so it's kind of hard for, I think, someone on the U.S. men's national team to be as popular. First of all, they're not going to be the GOAT. They're not going to have led their team to a World Cup championship. It's going to be hard. Can it be done? Sure, it can. And someone, you know, a marketing person for the U.S. men's national team has got to get busy on that right now.
Rick, you're telling me Jesse, Jimmy, and I didn't put a foundation for there to be a superstar?
Well, then my last part of this question is, does that mean that we will see bigger marketing for someone like Jude Bellingham or Erling Haaland, or are these people going to be more the stars, the marketing stars of the U.S. held World Cup?
You know, we're going to be looking for a star, but someone's got to perform, right? And so we're going to go into a couple of games that are going to give us the chance to build heroes. And those heroes have got to suddenly, you know, represent. They got to produce. My hope is they will. Let's do it starting this summer with Copa. But if they don't, it gets harder and harder for the marketers to go to a Nike or go to a McDonald's, a Coke, a Visa, whoever you have, and say, hey, we want you to get behind this athlete, and we can get them for you really affordably. And we're predicting they're going to be a major star of the World Cup. And you're going to have a bunch of experts. What's the best prediction you're hearing for the U.S. team in 26 right now? If you guys were polled, what's the highest that anyone is projecting?
Quarterfinals, semifinals?
Semifinals would be
that's ideal.
Probably the highest. expectation.
So semis is amazing. If we achieve semis in 26, then we will have people who have delivered that. And whether that's going to be an unconscious goaltender who stops everything, or it's going to be a striker who actually puts the ball in the net a bunch of times. But we're waiting for that hero to arise. And as soon as they do, we'll be off to the races.
So I got a story ahead of the 2006 World Cup. This was a problem too, right? You're trying to build personalities and profiles. And we had Landon Donovan, DeMarcus Beasley, Clint Dempsey, who hadn't emerged as Clint just yet. This was going to be his first World Cup. And there was a bit on David Letterman. And Letterman leaned into this. Him and his writers leaned into this. Like, hey, guys, listen, we got the 2006 World Cup team and nobody knows who they are. Let's take a look at the team. And they're like, well, how about this guy? And it was a photo of me. So I've got a bone to pick with David Letterman. Didn't even know my name. This guy, amazing. But
I wish you never told me that.
That was your 15 seconds of fame right
there. I had it. I was on Letterman.
I'll never forget that.
And I was known as this guy for David Letterman. And I'll take it. They threw up photos of everybody. But the point remains, and I think it still in some ways rings true today. And I think it's interesting that you bring up this thing about if we get to the semifinal, then we've had a hero emerge. Because we had it in 2010. Landon Donovan scored that goal against Algeria, sent everybody into euphoria at home. They had all the videos of people in bars losing their mind when he scored that last-minute goal. But then we lose in the next round. And then you lose that momentum that you can continue to build that narrative. And then even in Qatar, we get out of our tough group, and then we have a chance to build on that, and then we lose to the Dutch. And so we can't build on that. Whereas the women, as a contrast, have done that. They have climbed that mountain multiple times. They've had these heroic moments, and these players continue to show that consistency in big games and obviously had four World Cups to show for it. And I think that's what slows us down a little bit, to your point. So I've got this all figured out. We just need someone to date Taylor Swift. And so if we can make that happen, that's really going to cut through all the clutter, Rick. And so when I think about other stars that have done a good job that are in our region, Alphonso Davies is a player who plays for Canada who has really taken to social media and kind of cut through that clutter. And so I think that's someone you can build around because he has that likability via social media, whereas a lot of our guys don't do that. And so if they do, they're not one of our top players. And so I wonder how outside of dating Taylor Swift, what do you think we can do on the maybe social media front to build those profiles up?
Well, before we get to social media, Jimmy, I think the issue is Copa 24. All right. The problem with the World Cup is it's a quadrennial thing. So if you perform poorly in 26, no one wants you for 27. So what we really need to have happen, and it starts with social media, is we need players to emerge this summer so that sponsors and people that want to invest in men's soccer start to say, okay, we can ride these individuals through to, we've got a two-year runway, we can run through to 26. But if we go down and perform pretty poorly in Copa and nobody emerges, then it's really hard to say, well, now we're going to have these people in 26 and we're going to build around them because there's not going to be anything to support it.
So, given that, I want to look at what 1994 did for this country, right? And the U.S., they didn't win. They didn't get to a semifinal. They probably played above expectations, right? Getting out of the group still, mind you, as a third-place team, right? They still took third-place teams back then. So MLS soccer, right? The league is blown up. It grows. And then I think everyone starts to have now these idols, these role models that they want to eventually grow up to become. So how will that happen in after 2026? Do you see America really, really embracing the game? Because I think it's come a long way, but people still say it's not NBA, it's not NFL, you know, it's not even Major League Baseball. It's probably on par with NHL, but what will the effect of 2026 have on youth and also just the profession in this country?
Well, I think all of it, it's going to be massive. And that's why we're writing this book called The Rise of Major League Soccer, Building a Global Giant. And you've got a couple of factors that are really nicely staged right now. The Messi thing, he comes in 23 and really no one can look away. And he's performing, and I'm making up my statistics here, but he's practically performing at a goal a game rate. Right. And so it's pretty amazing to suddenly see this guy come to America. Why would he choose to play in MLS when he could have gone to Saudi Arabia? He could have stayed in Europe. And all of a sudden, everybody's talking about and the games are selling out. Then you've got Copa. Then you've got the World Cup. All of it is kind of coming together really nicely. And I think that Americans are starting to convert. And this is a generational issue. I'm an old guy here, right? So the average age of people watching Major League Baseball is like 55 or 56. I mean, it's old white guys that are getting ready to die. Right. And I think the younger generations, the millennials, although they're starting to become actually 40-year-olds, but generation A and B are going to be raised on soccer. And I think that's the exciting thing is that, you know, we're in the right place at the right time for the beautiful game. And I think you're going to see a lot more invested in soccer. And MLS is going to be one of the huge beneficiaries of it. And I think that'll lead to a better U.S. men's national team. And I think that ultimately, I'm hopeful you're right, Charlie, that we're going to see semis in 26, because if that happened, then you would believe we could be at, you know, be in and around that kind of Final Four group by 30. But if wow. we end up not doing anything, we don't make quarters on home ground, and then MLS has got to carry the ball through to 30.
Okay, that's my last question is about MLS. So the commissioner has kind of always said that the thing that's holding the league back right now is the next TV contract and the TV numbers. But the numbers are never really made available for what's actually happening. Like, do you have any empirical evidence on what's actually happening with the TV numbers, what that's meant over time? Are we making progress? Has Apple helped? Where do we stand with TV ratings right now with MLS?
I don't mean to suggest the question is flawed, but TV is dead, right? TV no longer matters. So what you really want to look at is the length of the Apple deal and the amount of money that Apple paid to have the kind of exclusivity that it has. So the best I've been able to determine is I think it's about $11 billion for 11 years. So it's about $1 billion a year. That's a huge indicator that Apple sees something in MLS, right? Long term, lots of money. And now they've got new technology that's going to come out. So the Vision Pro, the stuff that's going to start to introduce virtual reality or augmented reality. When we start wearing glasses like these and we start watching our MLS games on our glasses, now all of a sudden you're talking about a different universe than the four of us are used to, where the whole discussion would have been television.
Yeah, wow. I can ask about 20 follow-ups to that.
Again, think about how much smarter he just made our podcast.
This is so much smarter. Rick Burton, everybody. Rick, well done. Thank you so much for your time. Professor of Sports Management.
We need to recruit you to Boston College.
I can't wait to read your book about the growth of MLS. That's going to be really fascinating. We're going to have you back on once that drops. Rick, thank you again. We appreciate you. It's time for the stretch run of Call It What You Want and a fun little conversation to have. We referenced it a little bit earlier with regard to Haji Wright and being offside in the FA Cup semifinal extra time. Chuck, was he offside or not? Because it looked like Aaron Wan-Bissaka held him on. If you can't see it, well, then you're going to have to listen through it. Hopefully you've seen it online at some point. But if you are watching somewhere else, you can. We're talking toenail. He had an assist. That would have been a game-winning assist.
Remember, we all played in the pre-VAR days. Do you know how many times
that would have been?
If you're really fast, you know, you're quick, and you make good runs, how many times referees get that wrong, and there is no VAR to overturn it? I've been on the wrong side of that countless times. So, I can understand the disappointment from Haji Wright and the Coventry City fans, because that felt to me like it was on. When you're starting to analyze toenails, man, if he had size 9 feet like me, he would have been good. If he didn't have to have his big old size 12 or 14, whatever he has, looks like he got some huge feet. So,
like your big old little head.
But I'll tell you what, right now, I couldn't be more impressed and thrilled with his progress and his development over the past year. I mean, from the World Cup since he's been on a tear, and still has a long way to go, which is great. As Jesse alluded to, he's got a high ceiling. And so he's on the right pathway.
So Jesse, as we know, this sport can be very cruel, as evidenced by this call by VAR and Haji Wright. What's your all time most heartbreaking referee decision, either right or wrong? You have one?
I don't know. I just,
there's a couple of red cards in there, right?
Well, like I referenced once in Champions League when we played Bayern Munich that they allowed a goal that for me was clearly offside. It's always in the moment. There are all these little decisions. I mean, in MLS Cup when we played San Jose, I think, Jimmy, the first goal in 2003, right? Mm-hmm. The first goal, they called a foul on me and I think Walker, and he just fell down. And then Eklund stuffed the goal and we were down 1-0. And there was also, I played in, against Kansas City in 2000, and there was a we thought there was a foul on Diego Gutierrez that led to their first goal. But like at the same time, like, you know, I understood why all these calls get made, and just in the moment those things can really hurt. But you know, afterwards it's part of the game.
I guess I've got two. One was that bad handball or non-handball call against Aleko Eskandarian in the 2004 MLS Cup final, which I'm still bitter about. But leaving that one aside for a second, the worst one that I've ever witnessed on the field was the 2006 World Cup group stage game against Ghana. We needed to win to get into the knockout rounds. We would have played Brazil. And they called the penalty on Gooch just because he was taller than the little tiny guy from Ghana. And it was the worst.
Razak ping pong.
It was the worst call that I've ever seen. And when I watch it back, it doesn't make me feel any better. And it completely took the wind out of our sails right before halftime when we had fought hard. That's when Clint scored off a good ball from DeMarcus to make it 1-1 after Claudio got hurt on a play and they ended up scoring on when they took it off of him. But to this day, I still feel like they were waiting to make a call in the favor of Ghana. I don't, I'm not a conspiracy theory guy, but
Except for that.
And that, well, there was an argument to be made that Africa was hosting, and they were, it had been announced that Africa was hosting the 2010 World Cup, and they probably wanted an African team in the knockout rounds. I'm just throwing that out there. Anyway, it was just a really shady call. Go back and watch it if you can. It's just a size of, all Gooch does is go and head it, and the little guy falls. He doesn't even push him. Anyway,
Two more World Cup. There's in 2002 when we played Germany, and it's probably a handball on the goal line, right?
Yeah, that
we
don't get.
Then there's 2010 when I was the assistant, and somehow Mo Adu gets called for a foul where they were following him, and it would have made us, we would have gone up 3-2 against Slovenia. Obviously the World Cup, all these things get really highlighted.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm carrying that. That was a long time ago, and I'm still carrying it. Chuck, how about you? You got a referee decision to bring us home to end the show?
I haven't had a referee decision that I'd change or regret. The only one would be that 2002 World Cup where I felt egregious that there wasn't a handball called, because that was the time where you felt hope from that squad because of how they started the World Cup beating Portugal in the fashion that they did. You thought, whoa, this team could do something special. And they were on their way, especially when they beat Mexico in the round of 16. You thought, okay, maybe this team can get to a semifinal, and they were on the verge. So that's the one that really hurts.
Yeah, Greg Berhalter with the header on that one. I wonder if that would have counted, or if he would have scored, how his life would have changed. Maybe he would have been the national team coach for two consecutive World Cup cycles. I don't even know. All right, we're calling it a show. Call What You Want is done. We appreciate your support as always. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the games this week on the weekend, and we'll see you very, very soon. Later.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.